the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Let's read some verses then, shall we, from the book of Joshua. We're in the middle of a series right now on adventures with God, and the book of Joshua is all about that. This morning we were looking at the battle that took place when the walls of Jericho fell down, and now we're looking at the whole section that follows that, from chapter 6, the fall of Jericho, right up to chapter 12, which is the second main section of the book. Last week we started talking about the beginning of the book, the first five chapters. And we said chapters 1 to 6, really, including that battle in Jericho, are about starting out. And we talked about the main things that happened there. So just before reading, let's have a quick reminder of those. First of all, chapter 1 has the command to Joshua to be strong and very courageous, to go out and do what he's got to do in the name of God, knowing that God is going to be with him. He sends out some spies, and they go to Jericho, and there's a story of Rahab, the prostitute in Jericho, who has secretly become aware that the God of the Israelites is the real God, and that if she doesn't make an alliance with the Israelites pretty quickly, her whole family is going to be destroyed. So she shelters the spies at risk to her own life and says, "Now, you be good to me, and when you march into the city, remember me and my family." Then in chapter 3, the spies go back, and Joshua gets ready to cross the Jordan, and there's that whole section there about what they do to get ready. In chapter 4, they go across, and having gone across the Jordan, they leave 12 stones as markers, as memorials of what has happened to them up to now in their journey. Then in chapter 5, there's some other stuff that needs to happen before they get ready to go into Jericho. For a whole generation, no Israelite male has been circumcised. And that's something that's supposed to happen. It's part of the deal that they made with God. And so they do that once again before they go into battle. And that's just one of the three things that happens in chapter 5. There's also the new food that they have to eat. They're in the land that they're going to take over now. And so as a result, God says, right, fine, you can start eating from the food of the land itself. You'll be reliant on harvests, on my natural provision from now on. You're not wandering through the desert any longer. So that mysterious food that's appeared every morning, the manna, is just not going to be there for you anymore. And the third thing that happens is Joshua is somewhere between Gilgal, where the Israelites are camped, and the walls of Jericho, and suddenly he looks up and there's a man in front of him with a drawn sword. Immediately he assumes a position for battle and says, "Okay, friend or foe, our side or their side?" And the man says, strangely, "I'm not on either side. I'm the commander of the Lord, the hosts of the Lord." And Joshua realizes that he's been thinking of it in terms of, I must do this, they will do that. A purely human conflict, and it's not. It's a supernatural struggle that's going on. So, we said that's what's there in the first section of it. And we said that if you look at what these chapters are telling us, they're telling us about different things that God gives us that get us ready for an adventure with him. And the five are just listed there. If you didn't hear it next week, there's a tape around, I think. Well, after that, as we saw this morning, the big thing that happens is the start of the fighting, Jericho. Massive victory, tremendous victory, and the Israelites really start to believe, we can do this. We may be smaller than any of the seven tribes that are already in this country, but God is with us and we can win victories. And so now they start out on the second bit, the second section, which is about, I think, winning through. It's a section in which all of the major battles of the book take place. So let's just skip through a few verses and get an idea of how the land lies in there. Let's start with chapter 7, which is on page 210, if you hadn't found it already, and we'll just read a few verses there. The Israelites were told before they went into Jericho that they must not touch any of the stuff that was left there. The gold, the silver, the booty was to go into the Lord's treasury. It belonged to him. This was no day on which the Israelites should profit for themselves. The people were to be killed. There was going to be no advantage to the Israelites at all from this victory. This one belonged to God. And God warned them that if they took things back into the camp that belonged to him, then they would put themselves under condemnation, because these are contaminated goods coming from a contaminated city, and the poison would spread if it got into the Israelite camp. Well, that's where chapter 7 starts. Verse 1. But the Israelites were unfaithful in regard to the devoted things, Achan, son of Carmi, the son of Zimri, the son of Zerah of the tribe of Judah, took some of them. So the Lord's anger burned against Israel. Now Joshua sent men from Jericho to Ai, which is near Beth Avon, to the east of Bethel, and told them, go up and spy out the region. Ai was the next smaller city to be taken after Jericho. Verse 3, when they returned to Joshua, they said, not all the army will have to go up against Ai. Send 2,000 or 3,000 men to take it, and do not weary the whole army, for only a few people live there. After Jericho, this one's going to be a pushover. It's going to be dead easy. So about 3,000 went up, but they were routed by the men of Ai, who killed about 36 of them. They chased the Israelites from the city gate as far as the stone quarries and struck them down on the slopes. At this, the hearts of the people melted in fear and became like water. And Joshua goes to God and says, what's going on? What's happening here? Have you just brought us here to allow us to be killed? And God says to him in verse 10, stand up. What are you doing down on your face? Israel has sinned. They've violated my commandment, which I commanded them to keep. They've taken some of the devoted things. They've stolen. They've lied. They've put them with their own possessions. And so Joshua goes and presents that to Israel. And gradually, bit by bit, works out who exactly has done it. And it was Achan, the person we met in verse 1. And verse 20, Achan replied, it is true. I have sinned against the Lord, the God of Israel. This is what I have done. When I saw in the plunder a beautiful robe from Babylonia, 200 shekels of silver, and a bar of gold weighing 50 shekels, I coveted them and took them. They're hidden in the ground inside my tent with the silver underneath. So Joshua sent messengers. They ran to the tent, and there it was, hidden in his tent with the silver underneath. They took the things from the tent, brought them to Joshua and all the Israelites, and spread them out before the Lord. Then Joshua, together with all Israel, took Achan, son of Zerah, the silver, the robe, the gold bar, his sons and daughters, his cattle, donkeys, and sheep. Here we are, donkeys having a hard time again. His tent and all that he had, to the valley of Achor. Joshua said, why have you brought this trouble on us? The Lord will bring trouble on you today. Then all Israel stoned him, and after they had stoned the rest, they burned them. Tough stuff, isn't it? Chapter 8, we won't read any of this, but what happens in chapter 8 is that the Israelites manage to take Ai. Well, verse 20 of chapter 8, just for the flavour of it. The men of Ai look back. They've been tempted out of their own city and saw the smoke of the city rising against the sky, but they had no chance to escape in any direction. The Israelites who'd been fleeing towards the wilderness had turned back against their pursuers. But when Joshua and all Israel saw that the ambush had taken the city and that smoke was going up from the city, they turned round and attacked the men of Ai. Those in the ambush also came out of the city against them, so they were caught in the middle. And so Ai was burned, the city was destroyed, another target was achieved. After this, at the end of chapter 8, Joshua and his men go to Mount Ebal and build an altar, verse 30, to the Lord, the God of Israel. And there, verse 32, in the presence of the Israelites, Joshua copied on stones the law of Moses, which he had written. And there they recommit themselves to God's law and say, we're writing it in stone so that we won't forget it again. Verse 34, afterwards, Joshua read all the words of the law, the blessings and curses, just as it is written in the book of the law. There was not a word of all that Moses had commanded that Joshua did not read to the whole assembly of Israel, including the women and children and the foreigners who lived among them. Well, in chapter 9, another bunch of people enter the story, and they live just up the road. They're called the Gibeonites. And in verse 3, they're getting very worried. When the people of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai, they resorted to a ruse. They went as a delegation whose donkeys were loaded with worn-out sacks and old wineskins cracked and mended. They put worn and patched sandals on their feet and wore old clothes, and all the bread of their food supply was dry and moldy. Then they went to Joshua in the camp at Gilgal and said to him and the Israelites, oh, we have come from a distant country. Make a treaty with us. The Israelites, who were not very clever this morning, said to the Hivites, duh, but perhaps you live near us, so how can we make a treaty with you? We are your servants, they said to Joshua. But Joshua said, huh, who are you and where do you come from? They answered, your servants have come from a very distant country. And they say in verse 12, this bread of ours was warm when we packed it at home on the day when we left to come to you. But now see how dry and moldy it is. And the Israelites say, yep, that's pretty disgusting bread. Okay, you're telling the truth. We'll sign a treaty with you. They were fooled. And they got their comeuppance in chapter 10. Having realised that they had made a treaty with a bunch of people they were supposed to fight instead, they then found that having these allies was a dangerous thing, because it meant that once they were attacked, the Israelites were sworn to come and defend them. So, chapter 10 and verse 1, Adonai Zedek, king of Jerusalem, another local king living just down the road, heard that Joshua had taken Ai and totally destroyed it, doing to Ai and its king as he had done to Jericho and its king, and that the people of Gibeon had made a treaty of peace with Israel and had become their allies. He and his people were very much alarmed at this, because Gibeon was an important city, like one of the royal cities. It's a bit like, I suppose, a leading figure in the Labour Party joining the Conservatives or something like that. So Adonai Zedek, verse 3, appealed to Hoam, king of Hebron, Piram, king of Jarmuth. Why do I pick the verses with all the null names in it? Never mind. Japhia, king of Lachish, and Debir, king of Eglon. Come up and help me attack Gibeon, he said, because it has made peace with Joshua and the Israelites. And to cut a long story short, they do that. And Joshua manages to surprise them and fight against them. And there's this odd bit, verse 12, when on the day the Lord gave the Amorites over to Israel, Joshua said to the Lord in the presence of Israel, "Sun, stand still over Gibeon, and you, moon, over the valley of Ajalon." So the sun stood still, and the moon stopped, till the nation avenged itself on its enemies, as it is written in the book of Jasher. What exactly happened? Well, clearly the earth did not stop spinning, or lots of people would have fallen off. So it seems unlikely that it was actually stopped scientifically in that way. What actually did happen? We don't know. Some people would say, oh well, probably what happened was just that Joshua was praying that the sun wouldn't get as hot as it normally does when it rises in the sky into the afternoon. And perhaps strange climatic conditions, because there were hailstones dropping all over the place, meant that it just didn't get warm all day. And so the Israelites were able to keep on killing and slaughtering all day long without the heat making them think, oh, we need a break, we need to sit down and have a rest. That might be it. Or there might be something more mysterious going on. Might be some sort of time slip, in which case, as far as Joshua and the people there in the battle were concerned, time just didn't function as it normally does. I don't know how that works at all. There are all sorts of paranormal stories about things like that happening, but no proof for any of them. So who knows what's going on? The one thing you can take away from this passage, from the details that we do have, is that something miraculous was happening. God was proving once again to the Israelites he was on their side. And so the five kings who had leagued together against Joshua made the mistake of all hiding in the same place, which was a cave. Joshua managed to get his men to roll stones about it and keep them in safekeeping until he'd finished killing off all of their followers. Then he came and let them out of the cave and killed them too. So that was chapter 10. And that leaves us with just two chapters to go, and then we can actually start talking about it. Chapter 11 is about the other end of the country. Joshua has now dealt with just about every significant town and every significant king in the south, or in the centre of the country, but that gives him control of the whole of the south. Up in the north, there are much more formidable foes. And there's another very big city. Jericho was important as a military stronghold, a strategic centre, a garrison, as we said this morning. But in the north, there was a wealthy city of Hazor. And when you look at the foundations of Hazor today, okay, it was built on by Solomon and all sorts of other people afterwards, but if you go right back to the Canaanite foundations, you can see it was an absolutely massive people settlement. And so there was strength in the north. And when the northern people thought they'd get together and oppose Joshua, this was a really massive, massive army that was taking the Israelites very, very seriously. And chapter 11 and verse 4 says, they came out with all their troops and a large number of horses and chariots, a huge army as numerous as the sand on the seashore. All these kings joined forces and made camp together at the waters of Merom to fight against Israel. And the Lord said to Joshua, "Do not be afraid of them, because by this time tomorrow I will hand all of them slain over to Israel. You are to hamstring their horses," which means cutting their tendons in such a way that they'll never be of use as horses to ride on anymore. Horrible, but there you go. "And burn their chariots." And in fact, this is exactly what happens. And in chapter 12, which I do not propose to read because it's got even more long names in it, you have a list in order, it would appear, from start to finish of each of the 31 kings that they managed to get rid of on their way up to this point. And there ends the section about winning through. Okay, so if that's what's there, how do we divide it up? Well, I want to suggest that in this section, in the winning through section, you've got various things going on. First of all, you've got two sins. The Israelites have got it all right up to this point, right up to the capture of Jericho. But they're human. They're imperfect. Although they're much better than the generation that died in the desert, and they've learned a few things from their mistakes, they are still capable of getting it wrong. And that's one of the encouraging things about this section, isn't it? It isn't a blueprint story of perfect people who did everything absolutely right. These were people who messed up with God just as we do. And yet, out of their mistakes, God still managed to bring victory. Maybe not quite in the way that ideally he would have done it. But all the same, the wrong things they did still managed to contribute towards the solution that God wanted to happen. So you have those two sins, one in 7 to 8 and one in 9 to 10. And the end result of it, surprisingly, is that the whole of the south is won. Despite the fact that Joshua's done it the wrong way around, he's managed to end up doing well. And that leaves you the final two chapters, 11 and 12, and there you find that the north is won too. So that's basically what happens in the section. Let's just retrace a little bit and see how the Israelites have got this far. They started off, if you remember, coming up the country on the east side, the right-hand side of that map. And they managed to conquer on their way into their promised land two very, very big and important kings. In the north, there was a king called Og, the king of Bashan. And in the south, there was a relative of his called Sihon. They'd actually tried to cross through Sihon's land. They had to do that to get to the borders of the Jordan. And they'd sent a polite message to Sihon saying, please, can we pass through? They'd asked if they could have what the old East German government would have called a transit visa. You can go through to Berlin on our motorway, but you must not stop at the service area. You must not take a road off to the right or the left. You must just stay straight on the road and go right through. That was all the Israelites wanted to do. Well, they did want a bit of food on the way across, but that was the only thing they asked for. But Sihon wasn't having any of it. And so he came out to attack them. And God said to Joshua, well, Moses actually in those days, God said to Moses, don't worry, you're going to win this one. And against all odds, against a vastly superior army, the Israelites did. That worried Og up in the north, who was a much bigger king. He had 60 cities under his control. And that was massive. I mean, if you look at the list of kings in chapter 12 of all of the people on the other side of the Jordan that the Israelites managed to knock off their thrones, you find that they were in control of perhaps just one city, one settlement, one small patch of territory. And John Goldingay, the great Bible scholar, has compared the kings of the Canaanite towns to sheriffs in the Wild West. You know, one tin star, one town to look after. I am the law. One saloon, one church, one general store. That was the kind of general feel of it. But Og had 60 saloons and 60 general stores to look after. So he was big stuff. And so when the Israelites defeated him, the news spread all over the region very, very quickly. No wonder that as we started this morning to read, the gates of Jericho were shut and barred against the Israelites. Before they came to across the river, they were camped in that place right on the right-hand side where I've put the circle. And after the spies came back from Jericho, they advanced to the river and they got ready to cross. They went across, they put up the stones, as we saw last week, and they went and camped at a place called Gilgal. Gilgal was not far outside Jericho. As you can see, Jericho is the yellow dot on the left-hand side of the map. And it was at Gilgal that they were circumcised, that they got themselves ready, and then, of course, they marched onto Jericho and took Jericho after that. So far, so good. But that was when things started to go wrong, and sin started to come into the picture for the first time. Now, for many years, people have said there are really two kinds of sins. I think this started with the Roman Catholic Church, but I was unable to find out just who made this division to start with. But it's a sensible one, isn't it? There are sins of omission and sins of commission. And I think you get one of each in this section. The sin of commission is something you do. A sin of omission is something you don't do. When you deliberately do the wrong thing, that's a sin of commission. When you know what the right thing is, but you don't do it, that's a sin of omission. You leave something out. And I think that's in chapters 7 and 8, with the story of Achan, you get a story of commission. Achan deliberately, knowing he shouldn't, knowing he's been told not to, knowing he's been warned by the most dreadful penalties, takes deliberately things that he knows belong to God and don't belong to him. And then in chapters 9 and 10, you've got a sin of omission. When the Gibeonites come with their mouldy loaves and their cracked water bottles, the Israelites start to think, well, this story makes sense, let's form an alliance. And there's one significant verse that we didn't read in chapter 9 that says, but they did not ask the Lord. They knew what they should have done. When they didn't know where to go, they should have gone to God and got his wisdom on the situation. But perhaps they were getting a bit cocky now. They'd seen so many victories. They just sorted out sin in their own camp. They felt very self-righteous and very full of spirituality, because hadn't they just chiseled out all the words of the law and read them out in public as well? And they'd recommitted themselves in the covenant. Sometimes it's when we're full of spiritual pride that we're most ready for a fall, because we won't do anything deliberately. We won't commit any sins of commission, but we may leave something out simply because we're so full of ourselves. And I think that's what happened in that second case. And so those sins had consequences. The sin of Achan and Ai, the sin of Achan, as we've seen, led to judgment, not just for him, but for the rest of his family. And I don't know how involved they were in his sin. I guess they didn't have much chance to do anything about it. If your dad turns up at the tent and says, look what I've got this Babylonian garment and lots of silver. Now, are you going to tell Joshua, or are you going to keep quiet? There's not much you can do about it, really. Maybe they didn't know at all. But the fact is, they were still judged along with Achan. And although that's harsh and brutal and prehistoric, what it's saying is sin has its impact on people around you. You are not the only one who suffers if you do something wrong. And your sin, your disobedience to God, your flickering commitment will have its impact on those closest to you, on your kids, on your marriage relationship, on your close friends, because you cannot live in a way that God has not made you to live without causing strains and pressures, not just for yourself, but for everybody else as well. And so what God is showing through that harsh, brutal lesson is that when we deviate from the path we know we ought to be on, when we go out and commit sins deliberately, we are buying trouble for ourselves. And as Joshua said to Achan, you've caused trouble for us, and the Lord's going to trouble you this day. The sin of omission had its own consequence as well. It led to another battle. Because the Gibeonites had managed to make a deal with Joshua, suddenly the neighbouring king said, whoa, we can't have this, something's got to give here. Whoa, we've got to stop this thing before it gets too far. Because Gibeon was not very far from Jerusalem, or any of those five kings for that matter, as you'll see on the map in a moment. And so they came together and tried to defeat Gibeon, do a surprise attack and reclaim that territory before Joshua was ready for them. And that's one thing that sin will sometimes do. When we leave things out, when we're lulled into a sense of complacency, we leave ourselves exposed, and the devil can attack suddenly before we're ready for him. But through the grace of God, Joshua was able to survive that one as well. Here's the story, just to put it on the map to make it a little bit more intelligible. There's Gilgal, where the Israelites are camped still. There's the city of Gibeon, from which the Gibeonites have come, not far enough for the bread to go moldy, as you can see. And Jerusalem, where's Jerusalem? Well, Jerusalem is just down the road there. And if you look at the scale of the maps, it's, what, 3 miles away from Gibeon? So that's scary, isn't it, for the king of Jerusalem? And so he gets the others together. And he goes to the king of those other four towns. There's Hebron, Jarmuth, who else have we got? Lachish, and Eglon. And those five kings together march against Gibeon. Well, to cut a long story short, and you can read it in Joshua, Joshua manages to attack before they realize he can. And as a result, they go and run. And they say that the army ran as far as the borders of what that place is called, Azekah, or I can't remember. But down there, and also down as far as Makkedah. We're not sure where that is, but we know there are caves where I've put that green dot. So that's the likely place where Makkedah was, because all the kings had to go into a cave there. And you can see what they're doing. They're scattering from Gibeon in those two directions because they're trying to get back desperately inside their cities and slam the gate, so that at least they can be back in the fortress by the time Joshua comes. And that's why Joshua says the thing about sun, stand still, and moon, don't do your stuff, and so on. Let's carry on with this, because he realizes they're winning. And in fact, what happened was that, but for a few survivors, as you can read in the chapter for yourself, Most of the men who tried to get back into their city didn't make it. And Joshua and the Israelites were able to account for the lot of them. Meanwhile, in the lower green dots, you have the five kings all crowded together into a cave, but detected very quickly. And so Joshua brings them out and kills them. And although these towns may one of these days rise against the Israelites again, at the moment they have no soldiers, they have no kings, the resistance is defeated. It's all over. If you want a 3D picture of what happened in the central and southern campaign, there it is, same sort of thing going on. You can see how just above the Dead Sea there, Joshua crosses the Jordan, there's Jericho, and then Gibeon a little bit further on, and the scattering of the kings down towards the south. But we don't need to look at that because that's what we've just been looking at already. So, where have we gone to in this? Well, we said two sins, the sin of commission with Achan, the sin of omission with Gibeon, and that leading on to consequences. But one unexpected consequence, the south is won. You see, just because we get it wrong doesn't mean that God gives up on us. He's not a petulant God. He doesn't sulk. He doesn't say, right, because you haven't gone my way, I'm cutting off all connection with you. I'm not helping you anymore. You said you were going to be my people. Right, you've broken your side of the deal. I'll break mine. No, we can push God so far sometimes that his promises cease to be active. And later on in the book of Joshua, you'll find that God says to the Israelites, because you've messed about so much, I am not going to let you wipe out these people any longer. No, they're going to continue. They're going to live and there'll be a thorn in your flesh for generations to come. I'm not going to keep that part of the deal because you've backed down so far. So it is possible to try God's patience beyond a certain limit. But God's heart is to forgive. God's heart is to restore. And if we miss God's plan A, then it's always likely that he's going to come up with a plan B. The story I always think of when I'm making this point is the story of when the Israelites wanted a king. Do you remember they were never supposed to have one? And Samuel said, look, you don't want a king. You have a king, he'll build a palace. Who's going to pay for that? You guys are. He's going to draft your young men, your sons and your daughters into his service. Your daughters will be polishing his gold objects and your sons will be fighting and getting themselves killed in wars. You don't want that. The king will give you taxes. And they say, what are taxes? Yeah, you don't want to know about that. Don't worry about it. It'll all happen to you the moment you get a king. And they said, no, but we will have a king and be like the nations round about us. And so in the end, it says, God granted the request but sent leanness to their soul with it. They got what they wanted, but they got all the consequences too. And the interesting thing is that when Samuel has found the king for them that God has led them to, he makes a little speech and he says, well, I'm going home now because you won't need me anymore. You've got your king. He can look after you from now on. But he said, God forbid that I should sin against the Lord by ceasing to pray for you. Isn't that great? You're off in the wrong direction. I warned you. The tax returns are already in the post. You've got the king set up and, well, it's all going to happen, just like we said. But it would be a sin against the Lord if I were to give up praying for you right now. God hasn't given up on you, so I can't either. And so, despite the fact that Joshua and his men get it wrong in this first section, still they manage to win the south. God's plan B works through and they win anyway. Well, where does that take us on to? Chapters 11 to 12 and then we finish the whole section. What happens in 11 to 12 is the conquering of the north. And as we saw, the country was divided into two parts. That's the area, that green area, really, where the southern campaign has already taken on, the one that we've described. And now the northern campaign begins with all of those northern kings getting together with their massive, massive army up in the pink area in the north there. And by the Sea of Galilee, which you can probably see, that big blip, that circle thing that comes out of the bottom of the pink square there, by the Sea of Galilee, there's a place called the Waters of Merom, and that's where they decide to pitch the battle with Joshua. And Joshua comes up to fight them. And to cut a long story short, God gives them the victory. Three stages to it. After the Israelites capture several cities in the south, King Jabin of Hazor, the big city we described, calls on several kings in the northern in northern Canaan to fight against the Israelites. Stage two, Joshua actually arrives. The Israelites advance from southern Canaan, and they take on the Canaanites at the waters of Merom. And stage three, well, the Canaanites run away. And they run to the north because they have nowhere else to go. And so all the way up the coast, they're pursued by the people of Israel. and in the heartland of the Anakites, the giants, the massive people who made the Israelites quake because they were so tall and so wide, and all over the place, the Israelites have victory after victory. Meanwhile, Joshua turns south and takes on Hazor. Oh, that's just a map of the northern campaign. We'll forget that one. This is what Hazor looks like from the air. At least this is the site of Hazor today. And in Solomon's day, it was only the bit at the top of the hill that was a city. But in the days of the Canaanites, it spread all over the base of the hill as well. It was an absolutely massive settlement. But Joshua had destroyed their army already. Their king was dead. They were completely defenseless, and so he was able to take the city and destroy it as he wanted. And those are some of the Canaanite foundations of the palace where King Jabin used to live that have been left behind in the ruins of Hazor for us. So that's where we're up to. I'm going to stop in a moment now, and I think we have 10 minutes. But Chris, are you going to who's Chris? Oh, there he is. Are you going to introduce that? Okay, brilliant. Let me just give you one more summary of this then, and that's that was last week's. Jericho was this morning, and tonight we've been talking about winning through. What has God got to teach us from this? Well, that even sin doesn't necessarily derail his plan. We have to be careful. We need to watch that we're walking in the way that he's indicated. We can lose out by committing deliberately things that we shouldn't, or omitting to do things that we should be doing. James says, "To him who knows to do good and doesn't do it, to him it is sin." So knowing the truth and not carrying it through in our lives is just as bad as actually deliberately committing an act. But through our sinfulness, despite that, God wants to forgive us, and his plan B can bring us to victory. From plan B, Joshua and the others were able to go on to win the north as well. And as a result, you end up in chapter 12 with a list of 31 kings that God has delivered into their hands. Every promise he's made has been kept. There are still Canaanites scattered throughout the land. These are not perfect Israelites, and they've made problems for themselves for the future because they haven't followed God perfectly. And in your life and mine, all the way through our lives, there will be weaknesses, there will be failures, there will be temptations, there will be things that rise up against us and prevent us being everything we want to be. Nonetheless, living in the presence of all of those influences, the Israelites have found that God can be sovereign and God can bring peace and rest where there has been no peace and rest until